The Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project was produced in association with the 3rd Annual Institute of African Studies Conference and FeshRift in honor of Linda Freeman, Solidarity and Shifting Patterns of Hegemony in Southern Africa, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives, which was held on March 1st and 2nd, 2018 at Carleton University. This Oral Histories Project consists of interviews with participants of the conference, including activists, aid workers, diplomats, and politicians, who volunteered to discuss their personal experiences as part of the anti-apartheid movement in Canada. The interviews were conducted by Susan Bazilli, PhD student at the University of British Columbia, and by myself, Michael Buchert, a PhD student at Carleton University. In this interview, John and Elena Schramm sat down with me to talk about their experiences working for the Canadian Embassy in South Africa. This was recorded on February 28, 2018 at Carleton University.
Okay, well, I'm John Schramm, and from 1988 until 1992, I was what was called a minister counselor in the embassy in Pretoria. And we'd been sent there by essentially at that time a conservative government who it turned out were absolutely committed, because Canadians in general were committed to doing something about apartheid, and they were looking for somebody to do that job. I had done an MA in African Studies at the University of Ghana, and I was well known in the department, I think, even at that age, for having a vested interest in Africa. We'd been on posting already in Nigeria, and so when the head of the task force in our department was looking for somebody to suggest to go to Pretoria, he hit on my name.
I'm Elena Schramm, John's wife, and I was hired to administer the Dialogue Fund, which I think started out at about $1.2 million and supported all the anti-apartheid activities other than direct funding to political parties. And part of that was also, as a separate budget, was the anti-censorship and anti-propaganda fund, which I also ran, and the third was the public affairs fund, which was to get the message across.
So I just wanted to start by asking you, when was the first time that you learned about the situation in South Africa, and what shaped your thinking about it?
Well, because the two of us had been in Nigeria, because I'd gone to school in Ghana, we had a great many Nigerian and Ghanaian friends. We're relatively familiar with the situation right from the start. When we were first married, the first night, I think, in our apartment here in Ottawa, when I joined what was then External Affairs, my wife thought that she had done a wonderful thing for me and went out, and when I came home from the from work, there was a bottle of wine, and I took one look at it, and it was Parle Riesling, and I had to tell her I wouldn't drink Parle Riesling because Canadians were united in boycotting things from South Africa. So it had long been our idea that we should all be fighting against apartheid. That was a very strongly held Canadian idea in those days. Our difficulty was thinking that somebody with so many African friends, should we really agree to go to South Africa, or shouldn't we be closing the mission down? What were we doing there? So in the end, we asked our Ghanaian friends, our Nigerian friends, people in the department, and finally agreed that if somebody had to do it, we'd be the perfect ones to do it. So we did.
In fact, I would say that your interest in South Africa went back to when you were a teenager and first read Cry of the Beloved Country.
Yes, that's true,
too. So it's been long, heartfelt.
So how did you get involved, or what was your relationship to the anti-apartheid movement?
Both my wife and I were hired, were sent to South Africa with three purposes. One was to demonstrate that Canadians, like at that time virtually everyone else in the Commonwealth, and that in those days the Commonwealth was one of our major platforms for action on South Africa, that Canadians wanted to see the end of apartheid. It seemed to be an issue that more than any other issue since the Second World War, I think, had united Canadians. So we went off there being told that our job was in part to get across the message that countries that South Africa wanted to identify with Those included New Zealand, Australia, the so-called Western countries. South Africa wanted, the Afrikaner government wanted to be seen as a Christian outpost fighting off this communist, godless communism that were supporting the ANC and African freedom movements. So we were to show them quite to the contrary, that they were held in opprobrium with a system like apartheid. We were sent off to try to make life as miserable as we could for the South African government without being thrown out, to influence them to see that there was a better way to preserve Afrikanerdom, if that was what they were after, than the continuing apartheid. And we were sent abroad to try to support anti-apartheid groups, the very people you just asked me about. Elena's job was to support anti-apartheid groups in everything that we could possibly find to do. And that ranged, I've got piles of projects that I could tell you about here that perhaps you'd ask her and she would tell you about them. But that ranged from legal resources centers to lawyers for human rights. Every group that didn't have a political name attached to it, like, as Elena has said, the ANC itself or the UDF, but any other group that was working for democracy, that was working for the end of apartheid, we were to support. Well, it didn't take very long for people to realize that Elena, what did you say? You had how much money?
$1.2 million.
And the unique thing about this was that it came from the Treasury Board. It was not a CETA contribution. It was there because Brian Mulroney and Joe Clark wanted it there. It hasn't happened again, as far as I know. We called it the Dialogue Fund, and the point of this fund was to support organizations just exactly like that. And we could write the check without having to go through the bureaucracy back in Ottawa.
Up to $50,000.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And so you can be sure. I mean, I had a role there, too, and I'll talk. I hope you'll ask me about witnessing, as we called it, in a minute or two. But that meant that right from the beginning, people wanted to see us. They admired Canada. They thought our hearts were in the right place. When we came to leave, if I can jump forward, Nelson Mandela sat down and wrote us a long letter in longhand to tell us what Canada had done there and what we'd done there. So the whole point of us being there was to get to know anti-apartheid activists, every one of them, and boy, did we ever. And it was the most exciting thing because here were more evil going on than I had ever seen in my life, and yet at the same time, more saints and heroes. Of course, black, colored, and Indian South Africans, as they were then known, but also a small minority, I'm sad to say, but nonetheless, people who were prepared to sacrifice everything to try to bring democracy to apartheid. And that ranged from Helen Suzman and Helen Joseph, right through all the people who headed up these legal things, because there weren't very many black lawyers in those days who headed up businessmen association. There really were churches, there really were remarkable people. So one of the proudest things is that we were able to invite these people to our house, off the record, of course, away from the security cameras and serious, and at least once a month we would have a gathering that would attract everybody from Cyril Ramaphosa, who was a frequent guest, and not just black people, but anybody who was willing to work on getting rid of democracy. And of course, they found that very, getting rid of apartheid. And of course, they found this very satisfying to be able to have a place where they could talk like that. So the answer in spades is yes, we certainly did know them, and we still keep in touch.
Can you give me a sense of some of the kinds of organizations that you were supporting? It sounds like it's a very wide variety.
It was incredibly wide, but interestingly, we did really odd things. For instance, we buried Zef Motepeng, who was head of one of the not the ANC, but one of the Black Consciousness, because they came to us and they said we have no money to bury him, and we were able to do that. But we did things like, apart from the large organizations, we brought children together who had never met a person of the opposite race. We funded orchestras for children. We brought together women from the Afrikaner community who really had no idea what this black onslaught was going to do to them, in quotes. We brought together conservative groups. We went and saw Archbishop Tutu and helped with projects at Bishop Stowe. There was nothing that we weren't willing to help with if the embassy, right up to the ambassador, thought that it was valid.
Can I just add the part, and we were responsible for paying for an outfit called Five Freedom Forum to send the first white businessmen off to Lusaka to meet the ANC so that they wouldn't be afraid of them. Everybody thought that the ANC would usher in an era of chaotic socialism, and that wasn't their objective at the time, and that included the South African Communist Party. They went and met Thabo Mbeki, Joe Slovo, Oliver Tambo, and came back with very different views. Mm-hmm. Same thing, Elaine, this fund, Dialogue Fund, sent off students from Stellenbosch University, the epitome of Afrikanerdom, in Cape Province, to do the same thing. And we also did many, many things at a smaller level, including a Standing for Truth campaign that was designed to try to desegregate transport, try to desegregate healthcare. So we really did the range. People would come in and see Elena. I'm afraid she was much more popular than I was when we walked into a party or into some event. She, with her checkbook, attracted people at instantly when I actually had to go over and start a conversation. So that was how. And as I say, this was all unique for Canada. All of these things were unique. And any other diplomatic experience, we'd have been tossed out. And I was brought into foreign affairs on at least three occasions, and to be shown pictures of myself taken by the security forces, and told by my director over there that if this were to continue, we'd be thrown out. And this is something, may I continue? This is something I'd like to put across here, that our answer was, fine, you throw us out and we'll throw your embassy out of Ottawa. Frankly, you need your embassy in Ottawa far more than we need ours here. There are plenty of people in Canada who think we should have closed this embassy. We don't think so because we're actively supporting the struggle against apartheid. And boy, we were. So these people would invite me in. They would say, look, here you are. You seem to be praying here. You're singing the Nkontu Wisizwe. Sorry, Nkosi Sikelele Africa over here. You're hanging around with Nkontu Wisizwe. That was the armed, somebody from the armed struggle in the ANC. We have all these pictures. And our answer was, if we were sent here to sit around and drink tea, that would be fine. But the Canadian government wants us here doing something. And if I may just add a word about this, I had said that this was one issue that united Canadians. And I've read many pieces of skepticism, some of them will be here at this conference, about Joe Clark, who was then what we call the SSEA, Secretary of State for External Affairs, even the Prime Minister, questioning our real commitment to this. It was strong, I can tell you, because they were willing to take initiatives that we have never done someplace else and aren't likely, for various reasons that we could discuss later, to do again. Canadians had this deep-rooted feeling that apartheid was wrong, and this extended through churches, service clubs, certainly academics, people like Linda Freeman, who were honoring at this conference, John Saul, but ordinary Canadians, too, Rotary clubs, this sort of stuff, and NGOs. You've just talked to Jim McKinnon and many others. Boy, everybody was combined in saying that we really should be doing something effective. So Mulroney and Clark, whatever you think of their motivations, I happen to think that it was they were two of Canada's proudest moments, but they were reflecting a Canadian view. And as I say, that was to send us over there to support these people, to get to know them, to understand them, to discuss what they wanted, not what we thought they should have. And that's what we tried to do.
We also had a very active aid group, a CETA group, who funded, because I did some work for them, they funded the Canada Fund, which is traditional in most embassies in that part of the world anyway, and they also funded a very large educational fund. So we propped up the anti-apartheid movement in many ways. Just anecdotally, when John was saying that it was a visceral feeling amongst Canadians, I came home once and wanted to have a Walkman fixed and called and said to the man, could you fix it really quickly? I live in South Africa. And he said, wait a minute, you live in South Africa? And I said, yes. And he said, that'll be at least 2 weeks. but bring it in. And when I brought it in, he said, why are you in South Africa? And I told him, and he said, I can have that ready in an hour. So that was somebody in Nepean that, mm-hmm. you know, had no particular political affiliation, but was keen.
And this becomes relevant later when people ask, as indeed they will at the during this conference that we're about to have, well, how come we haven't done it elsewhere? I went on to be head of mission in Zimbabwe. Elena and I tried some of the same things there. They didn't work, obviously. What is it that made South Africa either something that we could duplicate elsewhere or that made it something that was unique? And one of the factors in all of this, we can come back to it if you want to, but one of the factors in all of this was simply that Canadians wanted it done. The Prime Minister there wanted it done. We were given a carte blanche to do it, and this isn't likely to happen. Most often, you don't want your embassy being closed. You don't want to be thrown out in a Middle Eastern country. The headquarters wants to make those decisions. And yet, in our case, in Canada's case, this was accepted.
Mm. I want to ask, you mentioned Ramaphosa and mm-hmm. members of MK, mm-hmm. and so I'm wondering what kind of relationship you had with the ANC, or maybe even other liberation movements as well, which would have been banned at the time.
Yeah, they were banned. Our son was a member of the ANC when we were there. He was there as a student at Woodmead, a boarding school, not far away, because that was aiming at a multiracial society. Sure, we all called them the UDF and then the MDN. The ANC itself was resident in Lusaka. I went there to see them. As I say, Elena's program focused, sent off different groups to talk to them. So yes, one of the best nights that I can remember spending was a night over a lot of whiskey with Joe Slovo, the head of the armed struggle, and Thabo Mbeki, who subsequently went on to become president. In Lusaka, where I was trying to convince them that the armed struggle was something passé, that they hadn't really succeeded at it, they should give it up. It made partners like Canada very uncomfortable. And of course, Joe Slovo was able to, well, he certainly surpassed me in whiskey consumption, but he was also able to refuse to consider getting rid of the armed struggle. So we knew them well enough that we could sit and talk about that kind of internal but very fundamental issue inside the country.
Yeah. And inside the country, mm-hmm. I mean, there was Cyril, mm-hmm. Who was a very good friend. In fact, we almost share a birthday, so we had a birthday party for us. But there was also Jay Naidu. I mean, they were all sort of legitimate, even with the banning, they were legitimate heads of organizations. Somebody that no one ever mentions is in Tata Mudlana, who was just a doctor. But he really was the head of the UDF, I believe. Am I right?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, in South Africa. And we saw a lot of him, and our son used to go back and forth to their house. So we had good relations.
In fact, our son spent an afternoon at Winnie Mandela's place in Soweto. We spent a lot of time driving into Soweto, driving around Atteridgeville, Mamelodi, two townships in near Pretoria, Khayelitsha. Anyway, this was our job. You know, we were instructed to do it, and we did it. So the point that I like to make in oral histories of this sort is that here was an occasion where Canada really did get it right. We got it right because Canadians wanted it to happen. Yeah. We got it right because the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister, if you want, SSEA, wanted it to happen. We got it right because every parliamentarian, we're going to hear from Walter MacLean during this thing, we're going to hear from David MacDonald, but they're at the lead of a whole group of parliamentarians who wanted it to happen. You're working here with other people who had a job, who worked with NGOs, whether this would ever be duplicated again in another situation, I'm not sure. We were just discussing that when you came out. But certainly in terms of Canadian history, one of my great sadnesses is that more Canadians don't know about it. Mm-hmm. And if I can add a little element just to show you how widespread this is, Anne Mitchell will be speaking later on. Anne was, I think, in charge of or had to do with well, Ted Scott, an archbishop, was in charge of it in Canada. But there was an outfit called the Defense and Aid Fund. And this really required Canadians all across the country to put money, and this is a bit of hyperbole now, but to put money in brown envelopes and send it off to be cleared by Archbishop Scott and then by Bishop Huddleston in England. It wasn't a religiously based thing. And somebody in South Africa, not the embassy, not the Dialogue Fund, somebody made sure this money got into the hands of political detainees whose families, whose breadwinners were in jail. The families couldn't pay for fees. They couldn't even get enough food. They certainly couldn't get lawyers of a stature that would be able to defend them against the white lawyers of the establishment. Mm-hmm. And this EDAF thing struck at Canadians in general. And would you put money in a brown envelope and send it off to somebody without, you'll never get a receipt, you'll never get a report, you couldn't possibly get a report, you won't even tell the embassy what's going on. So a large part of what Canadians did, and this had to do with NGOs every bit as much as anybody else, civil society, Canadians never got to know about. And they didn't ask to hear about it, but I wish now that there were some way of telling them that this was bloody heroic, if I can say so, what many of them did.
On the other hand of this, I'm very curious to hear about your experience relating to Pretoria at the time. You were making friends in the anti-apartheid movement, but relations with the South African government, what was that like?
Well, that's a good question, too. I said I would talk about my job, and for some reason I got talking about every other thing except... one of my jobs, the most visible by far, was what, as I said, we called witness. What was this? This was that all of these groups, and not just in Pretoria, all over the country, could pick up the phone and call the embassy and say, we're being raided, we've got a real situation on our hands, we're having a protest, we're having a funeral, the Delmas trialists are being... getting a verdict, the Uppington trialists, Elena visited the only woman on their death row many times. Why? This was our witnessing, because when they'd asked this, it was my job and a fellow named Brian Burton, before that Lucy Edwards, our job, we saw it, was to get out there and join them. So we were at literally every protest that we could get to, every demonstration that we could get to. We were rubber bulleted. We were tear gassed. We really were in the thick of things, and they certainly appreciated it. The only other embassy that came close to doing it, and they did come close, they did the same thing, Australians and Swedes.
And Dutch.
And the Dutch, sorry. The British were not in this business. The Americans were not in this group. They were saying, slowly, slowly, negotiate, be careful. It'll become a communist paradise if you push too hard. Talk to that nice man, Buthelezi. But for Canada, our job was to stick with to support these guys, and we went to everything. And sometimes I took my son, if I thought that might help. It was very dangerous stuff, very dangerous, in fact. But it was certainly rewarding. It had a little barb in the end of it, and that is that on a number of times I mentioned that Elena went to see the Evelyn Bruin, de Bruin, on death row. I went often either to see or to try to get people who'd been arrested, detained for demonstrating or for doing something even down to wearing a T-shirt. But of course, after I had done my thing, and very often they were let out because Canada was very much respected there, even by Afrikaners, once they were let out, I could go home and sit down and or have a swim in my swimming pool or sit down and have a bottle of beer because I had a green diplomatic card. Evelyn de Bruin and others had to go right on living there in Pretoria Central Prison. But they didn't hold that against us. They really did see this as a remarkable piece of evidence that the rest of the world was supporting them. And when we left, I think that was what Mandela, the support for the groups that I was talking about, and the witnessing, that's what he was writing about in his letter that Canada had done for South Africa. And interestingly enough, I must get this little barb in, he wasn't alone in thinking this was successful. You asked me about the apartheid government. picked both of the foreign minister who caused us so much trouble, had to admit that Joe Clark was the one foreign minister in the Commonwealth who had really made it his business to know what was going on, to understand the issues, and therefore that Pick, as much as he disliked him, intensely respected him. Mm. We had several people in the Afrikaner government. I always maintained relations with the director, a chap named Malcolm Ferguson, who interestingly enough was married to a Canadian. Once in a while we would have lunch together. I would tell him what our views were, which I must say he already knew because we told him frequently.
They
listened all the time on our phone. They listened on our, and he said that they not only took pictures of me, but they listened to the embassy. They made it their business to know what we were doing, which was fine because we wanted them to know what we were thinking. We were the good guys in all of this. We had a relationship of respect. The ambassador could go and see the head of their foreign affairs department. You certainly didn't invite them around for a social occasion. But on business, we made sure that we kept communications open. Now, there are many people who are going to be at this conference who think, as I said, that we should have closed the embassy. My experience both there and later in Zimbabwe was that that would have been the biggest mistake that Canada could have made, given the drive that we had to do something effective. Why do I say that? Denmark did close its embassy, and they are a country with Norway, Sweden, the Netherlands, that we call ourselves the like-minded group. We tend to think about things in the same way. Denmark withdrew and immediately lost all influence. Nobody paid any attention to them, either nationally, inside South Africa, or internationally, once they'd gone. They meant well. They gave a fiery speech, and that was the end. There are other people at our conference who are going to say that Canadians would have wished that our prime minister, our ministers, would have been more outspoken, would have done more. And this is true in Zimbabwe, too. More to condemn Mugabe in Zimbabwe, more to condemn the government in South Africa. If we'd been thrown out, we'd have had nothing to offer at all, either in either country. So our experience is, if you want to have influence, you stick with it, and you make sure that you don't cut off your ability to talk to people. In Zimbabwe, my European counterparts had all done that before I got there. They sounded off. Their ministers gave speeches at home about the so-called land grab. The result was they got to play golf all day because there wasn't anything else to do. Nobody wanted to talk to them. The government wouldn't work with them. They had trouble finding good aid programs because the government wouldn't join even the Ministry of Health again for a program about AIDS. So this, as I say, was a magical, I think, undertaking in that I was so close to the line in my witnessing Elena in what she was handing out, and this isn't the two of us, this was a whole embassy behind us, so close to the line, and yet if we had, we just managed always to keep in there to the point where when we left, everybody thought that probably the most useful thing in actually ending apartheid was what Canada had done.
If I could add that by the time we got there in 88, apartheid was starting to have holes in it. And the faster the holes appear, the faster they tried to glue them together. And it was obvious that it wasn't working. So we got there in 88, right on the cusp. We were there 88 to 92. And it needed, you know, it only needed a little bit of a nudge from a number of areas to sort of push it over the edge. And so we were very lucky to be able
to. Yes, we were lucky, and then they were lucky. And the other thing, before I sound too unctuous about all of this, is that there were a number of other things that happened, not least the fall of the Berlin Wall. All of a sudden, the communists, the godless communists, total onslaught from Moscow became a figment of people's imagination. That helped to open the way for peace, in which Canada was very active. Again, I went off over many times to Windhoek between South Africa and what was then called Southwest Africa, Namibia, and Angola, plus some Cubans. So there were things that happened in Southern Africa that made this an opportunity. Not the least of which was the president of South Africa, the Afrikaner president, having a stroke. B.W. Botha had a stroke. A fellow that we all thought was going to be very hard line and nasty, named F.W. de Klerk, took over, and my goodness, on February the 2nd of the year after he took over, he announced the unbanning of all these organizations. Well, that was just what we'd gone there for. Mm-hmm. And then Mandela was out, the 11th, anyway, shortly after. And they sat down for 2 years of negotiation and came up with what really is a miracle. Mm.
Did your relationship with the government change with the change in from Botha to de Klerk?
No, they didn't like us any more before or after. They didn't. We were quite... they knew what we thought. We were very outspoken. We said it publicly. Certainly, everybody said it in Canada. They knew what we were doing there. So, of course, we were always under suspicion, always watched. They were very careful of us. But I think, as Elena has said, they grasped the fact that things were moving in the opposite direction.
But we also, the Dialogue Fund also helped subsequently to fund pre-constitutional meetings,
okay.
A lot of meetings.
Yeah, we did a lot of that. Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point.
And
and
they also took a lot of lessons from the Canadian Constitution, and they credit us, I mean, they credit Canada with having helped them enormously to develop their own constitution.
And Keith Bazanson, who went on to be head of the IDRC, well, I guess he then was, came shortly after Mandela came out, and his organization and many other organizations quickly shifted gears to support these legal organizations that we've been talking about in planning for land reform, for a new constitution. One of the ideas that de Klerk, the new president, put forward to try to soften the blow for white South Africans and Afrikaners in particular, was the idea of maintaining what they called group rights. Have you heard about group rights? So I don't need to go into it. This was to assure everybody that they could go on being, they always said first black, colored, and Indian, but what they really meant was that Afrikaners can go on being Afrikaners and we don't have to vote for those. Anyway, it would have been, in fact, extended apartheid. It wouldn't have been any different. A trick. And so the Dialogue Fund put a lot of effort, and so did I'm a lawyer, a lot of effort into cultivating lawyers who had influence with their government. These now are generally white lawyers, of course, to convince them that group rights was a non-starter. And we've got a lovely painting at home from a guy named Olafir, judge, who gave us that to commemorate the fact that he was on, the head of the committee that was looking into this, and it was Canadians who brought the idea to the forefront that this wasn't going to work. This would be seen for what it was.
Could I just go back one step? And prior to the unbanning, prior to all that, the Dialogue Fund also supported groups that they had set up already in the country to examine land rights and all sorts of other issues in preparation for post-apartheid South Africa. That was a very big thing. So, in fact, when the unbanning took place and all the changes happened, they weren't completely unprepared. They had all sorts of organizations that were ready to mobilize. Mm-hmm. And
I should mention particularly the Black Sash. And the Black Sash were a bunch of, you know, what can you tell me?
The Black Sash is a very old organization. I'm not sure it goes back to the early 50s, I think, or maybe even earlier. And they were middle-class women like me. And
white women.
White women, I think exclusively. Mm-hmm. Later on, they started advising people on their legal rights. But initially, all they did was to stand on street corners with black sashes. Mm. In their pearls, in their sweater sets, and they would just have signs that just say, this is, you know, we need democracy, or something quite anodyne. And of course their children were laughed at, and their husbands were pilloried for doing that. But that was sort of a...
These signs were illegal. Many of them were detained, others were banned for doing it. And the reason that I was so anxious that she tell you about that is that here is an example of the sort of people that risked everything. And it was very possible to be a white South African and have the most wonderful life in the world. You didn't have to see townships. You didn't have to know what the laws were. In fact, you didn't have to even get off the pavement for people. The apartheid, for Canadians who don't understand what it was, really was exactly what it says. Separateness, completely. Black people went home at night to their own townships, or weren't allowed to come from their homelands. White people went to their houses and their places. No, they didn't eat together. They didn't go to movies together. They didn't do anything together. So this was quite a step forward to encourage groups to get together, not just to talk to governments, not to pressure governments and the security forces, but at the same time. But sanctions, I feel somebody like us should talk about a little bit, because I know that there are going to be many people here who think that Canada didn't do enough in our sanctions, and that we should have been much more. People always ask me about other countries, our sanctions in Zimbabwe, our sanctions in Sudan. I used to be ambassador to Sudan for a while, and we had sanctions there. Interestingly enough, my experience with financial sanctions, trade sanctions, is that they seldom work, primarily because there are always ways of getting what these countries want. There are always partners someplace who will step in and provide them. In South Africa's case, they had to be clandestine, but South Africans learned very quickly where to find things. And yes, I think that our sanctions regime, certainly it could have been stronger if the purpose had been to destroy South African financially or with trade. Well, that wasn't necessary, if I can say so. In retrospect, and I've talked to a lot of people about this, South Africans about this, black South Africans as well as white, because it was a major platform of the ANC. Even after the change came in South Africa, Canada remained very popular because we did not lift our sanctions, and I was very proud of us. We didn't lift sanctions until we could actually see that this was going the way that as promised. But the sanctions that ended up counting the most, and we had some of the most uncomfortable conversations and dinners and stuff, were the sports sanctions. And the sanctions that kept South Africans from traveling abroad, and the sanctions that somehow kept tourists from coming there, that's what hurt, ostracizing them, because they went to enormous lengths to convince themselves and us that here was this Christian, blatantly said this is a Christian bastion in Africa against the total communist, godless communist onslaught from Moscow. And we are upholding Western norms and Western civilization here. And so sanctions that came from countries like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the latter two in particular, since they played a lot of the same sports together and had historically, were, as I say, the absolute shock. And not being able to go to the Olympics, not being able to play in the Commonwealth Games. Boy, did this hurt. And we would go meet these people, be introduced to these people, and we could promise a half hour. And these were the guys who were running Anglo-American or running big mining companies, big corporations in South Africa, and they were just pillory us. What? About the trade sanctions? No. About sports and about ostracizing.
And the one at a party said to me after I got in trouble for talking about the Olympics, one of them said to me, what I don't understand is why people so much like us are not supporting us. Meaning, you know, we're all white guys, you guys and us, and why aren't you supporting us? It just never occurred to him.
So when Clark said, we're not trying to bring South Africa, this is our minister now, said, we're not trying to bring South Africa to its knees, we're trying to bring it to its senses, he was dead on, and it worked. And when I got to accompany a new head of mission in Pretoria, arrived a chap named Chris Westall, who was very activist, and gave quite a speech to the president when he was handing over his letters of credence. Usually you say relatively anodyne things and come in and go out. And Clark gave him quite a speech. De Klerk gave him quite a speech back again. But the essence had to do with this ostracizing and your sanctions that are trying to show us that we're inferior and we're not.
So in the end, what was it about the anti-apartheid movement internationally that was successful, do you think? Was it successful?
Yes, of course it was successful.
Sure. Well, why?
Well, it was successful, as they will say, and I would think that I would have to agree with them, a whole combination of things. But the biggest thing that made it successful, in my view, is that everybody agreed apartheid had to go. It was a universally held Eastern Bloc, Western Bloc. Nobody would stand up in the United Nations and defend apartheid. No member of parliament in anybody's country was going to stand up and say this is a great system. They might think it way down inside, but they certainly weren't going to stand up and say it. So here was an issue where virtually everybody, at least outwardly, agreed. And when you got to, I have a list here, within the Commonwealth, this is where Canada did its sanctions work, and we fought off Mrs. Thatcher, and we fought off President Reagan, who, as I say, wanted to cool things. We said Mulroney was quite blatant about telling them where they could get off on those things. I was at the 1987 CHOGM, Heads of Government meeting in Vancouver, and I know what he said. we were able to do our thing. Commonwealth Eminence Persons Group, where we tried to negotiate, that was put pressure on them. Mm-hmm. The UN Committee on Apartheid, that put pressure on them. These are things Walter McLean and David MacDonald can talk about much better than I can, because these were outside the country. Sanctions were part of it. The one thing I'm sorry to say this to my ANC colleagues, but the one thing that I don't think helped much was the armed struggle. They see it differently. They think that struck terror into the South Africans, but I frankly don't think it did, and that's a message for today too. Shooting people up and blowing up pylons and stuff probably doesn't do anything for the situation. So a mixture of dialogue, of support for the people there, coming at a time when people inside the country were willing to take tremendous risks, to risk their family and themselves. I mean, this is white South Africans, black South Africans go to jail. They were willing to do something about it. Churches, service clubs all over the world were willing to do something about it. Care Canada, Oxfam, these guys were all there doing something about it, keeping the issue alive in Canada, internationally, not just in Canada. And all of that together is what showed, I think, de Klerk that he simply couldn't keep the government going. And there were many people in his government who wanted to give it a try. But he realized that it just couldn't go on like that, and they needed out. So first he tried this group rights thing, and we'll just do it sort of softly, softly. They ended up instead in a full negotiation. And one last thing to say about what made it succeed was sensible people on the other side. Guys like Cyril Ramaphosa, he played a major role in the negotiations for the new South Africa, a major role. And he could always be counted on to keep things on track. When people lost their temper, started shouting off, and Cyril would bring it back and put it back where it was supposed to be. So South Africa is a miracle. I think it's a miracle for Canada too. But they seem to have the right people in the right places at the right time. They didn't become a communist hangout or a socialist disaster or chaos, as the business world thought they were going to do. They didn't retaliate, and one would have thought, far, far, far more black people than white people in South Africa. You would have thought that when they got the chance, they'd burn down houses and tear into wealthy areas. Quite to the contrary. Life is going on. And you asked me earlier about Pretoria, and then I will finish. Pretoria, when we were there, was the den of the hub, that and Bloemfontein, the hub of Afrikaner, traditional Afrikanerdom. We lived just behind a Dutch Reformed Church, an NGK church. Every Sunday, everybody was in church. There was no wine to be had any place anyway, but certainly there were no cafes serving wine to black and white people together up and down Church Street or something like this. As I said earlier, if you were black walking down Church Street, you were supposed to get off the pavement. As Lucy Edwards, the colleague who was there, we overlapped a bit, who got me into all of this, I think, introduced me to Elena and me to all of this, once said, people edit them out, and they did. So here we were with no interaction at all. When we lived in Zimbabwe and we went back again, and this did not happen in Zimbabwe, here were white people and black people sitting at the same outdoor table like you would see in Paris or like you would see in Nice or, one hopes, in the summer here in Canada. It really has been a transition. Unfortunately, it's been set back, as the economist says, it's been in limbo for 10 years. But I have no doubt Cyril and Co. will get it back on track.
Mm. Just two things that come to mind are the little humiliations of apartheid that I don't think people realized. It was the black person going into a store and seeing a lovely bunch of Granny Smith apples and being told, you're not touching those, you're having these, and having all the rotten ones come out. And it was going into a dry cleaner's and being asked if those clothes belonged to a black person, because if they did, they went into the dirty liquid. So there were the little humiliations.
What was your other story of Jan Smuts? That was quite a funny one, actually.
Oh, yes, if you had blacks and whites working together, the whites always handled the money. It was never allowed to be in black hands. And one day when we were queued up at Jan Smuts's house for a cup of tea, there were tons of black women working there and only one white woman. Usually there were more white women. And when there aren't enough white women, you had to go elsewhere to leave your money because she couldn't touch the money. It was very complicated, as was apartheid. And she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. There's just nobody here today." And John and I looked at each other and we said, "Nobody here today?" And she said, "Oh, well, there are lots of blacks."
There are about 35 women leaping all over the place, working every single second in the background. And she said, "There's nobody here today."
And another, at a lunch I went to once, a man, a big industrialist, I said, "Tell me about your business." And he said, went on about it was manufacturing. And then he went on to say, "We have just 17 people." And I said, "17 people doing all that?" And he said, "Oh, well, we have 300 blacks as well." So it was that. But the last thing I do want to say is that if Mandela had ever, you asked about whether it worked, if Mandela had died in prison, the story would have been quite different.
Mm. Good point.
So they had to get moving.
Can I just end up by reading this little letter from Mandela?
Oh, sure, please.
He's going to edit, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, please do.
Well, if you don't use it, fine. But this is, as you can imagine, in all of our 36 years in the Foreign Service, this is the prize moment. And this was in the front of a book that we were given at a farewell function in 1992. "Dear John and Elena, during your stay in South Africa, we've come to know and respect you as people who care about South Africa, about our trials and tribulations, our setbacks and victories. Through your warmth and understanding and positive contributions, you have won many friends, not only for yourself, but also for Canada. You have touched our hearts and will be sorely missed." Isn't that a nice thing? Mandela is easily the most striking person I have ever met.
This was an interview with John and Elena Schramm, conducted by Michael Buchert on February 28th, 2018 at Carleton University, as part of the Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project.